series, The Library of Wisdom and Compassion, isn't following the Lamrim series exactly, okay? In the Lamrim, you know, you'll notice that this the teachings for the person of the middle scope who aspires for nirvana, you know, that volume is the smallest one. Yeah? And when you talk about, and there's a little bit about the three higher trainings in there, a little higher training in wisdom under, you know, the perfection of wisdom. Okay. So here in this series, what we did is kind of divided it out. And so in the really embellished the higher training in concentration. And instead of putting a lot of the material that's usually under the perfection of meditative stability there, we put it all here in the higher training of concentration. Yeah, because, you know, sometimes when you just think of the perfections, it's like, oh, that's what you do after you've gotten generated bodhicitta. But that's not the case. I mean, ethical conduct and concentration we have to work on before, and certainly wisdom we have to learn something about too before. Okay, so we put that here. And in particular, we kept the Prasangika view, you know, with the perfection of wisdom, which is where it usually is, okay? But here we really took out and explained much more the how the Pali tradition approaches the higher training in wisdom and, you know, what you realize, what you meditate on. And so these teachings, you know, we'll be going into the four establishments of mindfulness. These teachings are found in the Mahayana tradition, and especially if you study the Ornament of Clear Realizations, they're right in there, okay? But usually with the Ornament of Clear Realizations, people are debating that. And I, you know, it's up to the individual whether they meditate on it or not. Okay, so it's usually, you know, for example, okay, I wanted to learn about the four establishments of mindfulness, but none of my teachers had taught us until then. I mean, all the teachings I had on wisdom and Lamrim and everything. There's nothing in it, so you know, that the teachers taught, because they usually hold wisdom until the third scope. But I wanted to learn about it, so I went and asked Geshe Sonam Rinchen for some teachings. So he gave some private teachings, me, and there was another couple of people, yeah, and. And it was like, wow, this is a fantastic practice. I really liked it, you know? And then when it came time, that all was before I started working on the book. Then when I, you know, was hooked into work on the book, then I thought, I've got to ask His Holiness about that too. So that was one of the questions I asked, you know, would he explain the, you know, the four establishments of mindfulness. So he went and got the text, yeah, and he brought it out. And as a prelude, and I think he mentions that in here, he does, he said that he really liked reading these sutras that talk about the Buddha as when he was alive on the earth and how he wandered around and talked to different people and discussed things and asked them questions and they asked him questions. And he was saying it really gave him a feeling, those sutras, of the Buddha as a person, what it would be like to meet the Buddha as as a person. Because usually in the Mahayana sutras, you know, it's all taking place in some pure land, and there's multitudes of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and there's all kinds of magical things, and he's radiating hair. And, you know, I mean, I'm sure those things happen too, but it's things that, you know, aren't in our current experience. And so seeing the Buddha, you know, get dressed in the morning and do his practice and then go out on alms round. You know, we go to the kitchen, to the dining room. But, you know, it makes everything, yeah, just how he lived his life. And one of the books that we brought back from Singapore this time, do you remember the title? It's Venerable Dhammika's book. He wrote about kind of what the Buddha, you know, would have been like, or, you know, and he's done a few interesting things, Venerable Dhammika. He wrote about all the plants that were mentioned in the Pali Sutras, and he's done quite, you know, research into different things. So one was about, what it would... Yeah, how the Buddha was as a person. Did you read that book when we were there? No? Okay, I don't know the name, but you should be able to find it somewhere in the library. Yeah, we brought it back. Yeah, I should write and ask him for a few more copies. And by the way, Bill Miller sent us copies of his little booklet. And whoever has them, put them in the book nook. That's where he wanted them. Okay, so because he sent us 10 copies and he wants people to be able to take them. That's just something I remembered now. Okay, so we'll start with the visualization and the chanting and then go on from there. So when we listen to the Dharma, it's very important to have an open mind. This is one of the qualities of a good student, somebody who is open-minded, who can see things more clearly instead of everything being filtered through their own beliefs, their own opinions, their own preconceptions. So that sounds well and good. The problem is we don't notice our preconceptions or our opinions or our ideas or beliefs. Yeah, instead we think all those things are objective reality. We don't see the subjective part in it, that we're seeing it through our filter. So needless to say, this produces a lot of discord in the world. And anger. So as much as possible when we're listening to the Dharma and in our life in general, to try and notice, especially the opinions and the preconceptions, and really question them. And also, as a good Dharma student, to question our beliefs, apply what the Buddha taught, think it over, see if it makes sense, and does what we believe in correspond to that? And if not, you know, what reasons do we have to support our view? So an open mind is also very helpful for generating compassion because it enables us to see sentient beings merely as suffering sentient beings without all of our opinions about them. And so that's kind of, you know, the basis for equilibrium, or equalizing self and others. Yeah, equality between friend, enemy, and stranger. We're all just sentient beings who want happiness and not suffering. And then on that basis, it becomes much easier to have compassion and therefore generate bodhicitta. So think about that for a moment. So as we get into this this chapter and talk about mindfulness and introspective awareness, generating those two mental factors are really, really helpful for detecting preconceptions and opinions and beliefs and so on. Okay, so before we actually dig into this chapter, somebody wrote me an email this last week and wanted to understand more about what, you know, hearing, thinking, and meditating, because we always hear that trio. Yeah. So hearing means it, you know, because it, at the Buddhist time and for many centuries afterwards, that's how people learned, was through hearing. You know, people were not literate, so they remembered everything. They seemed to have very good memories, too. So it could be, it's called, in the text, called hearing, but what it means is learning. So we first have to learn the Dharma. If we, you know, people in this country want to meditate, but in terms of Buddhist meditations, you've got to study and learn first so that you know how to meditate and what to meditate on. Otherwise, you kind of do what I did when I went to my first class, you know. I told you about that one. Okay, so learning. Then the second one, it's translated in a variety of different ways. It could be thinking, reflecting, what else?
Discussing.
Yeah. What? Okay. I'll give you one hilarious example. When I was a, you know, first learning the Dharma, I heard Lama Yeshe at one time mention subtle mind. And I thought, oh, subtle mind, you know, that sounds good. Yeah, what's subtle mind? So one day I was, sitting cross-legged, supposedly meditating, and my mind got very quiet, but I could see in the back of my mind, even though the front part was quiet, there was this underlying chatter going on. And I thought, that must be subtle mind. God, I was, you know, about as far off as you could get. But my point in telling you this embarrassing story is that just because we hear a term and impute our meanings on that term doesn't mean we've understood the term correctly. Or if we hear something explained, we may think, oh, I get that. But unless we, you know, debate it, discuss it, think about it, reflect on it, contemplate it, you know, we're not going to be sure if we've really understood it correctly or if we just have a superficial understanding. Okay, and you can see superficial understandings, you know, when you know you shouldn't do something, but you go ahead and do it anyway. Yeah, anybody ever had that? I think probably all of us. You know, it's like, oh, I have a precept about this. I shouldn't be doing this. Well, you know, it doesn't really matter. Nobody sees. You know, and excuses come, okay? So, you know, that superficial understanding is just, we just know the words. We haven't really thought about it in terms of how it applies to our life. Yeah, and that's really crucial. So that's that second step, thinking, reflecting, discussing, contemplating, yeah? Then the third step, meditating, yeah, is when we really integrate that understanding with our mind, okay? So it goes from being, yeah, it sounds like a good theory, you know, or it sounds, yeah, I think I understand that information correctly. But we don't really taste it yet, you know, or our taste is more superficial. So the meditating part is when you really sit quietly, you know, usually in meditation position. And there's different kinds of meditation, but here the kind we're talking about is, you know, the Lam Rim checking meditation that we're doing, the analytic meditation, where we go over the points and really think about them in terms of our life. How do I live this? Yeah, how do I really put this into practice? And so that's the meditating part of it. Okay, at our level of meditation. When you get more advanced, meditation becomes the unity of serenity and insight, but we're not there yet. Okay, so, yeah, so that's a little bit about those three. So they're helpful to know when we're studying these, yeah. So it isn't just sitting in class, taking some notes, being able to say, yes, there's four of this and naming the four, and then a year later you can't remember them, or a few months later you can't remember them. Yeah, anybody had that happen? Yeah. So, you know, that's because we really need to think deeply about them so that they become part of us. Okay, so chapter 11, Higher Training and Wisdom, the role of mindfulness and introspective awareness. So there's a few chapters on the higher training of wisdom. This is the first one. So the first section is introduction to the 37 harmonies with awakening. Now, 37 harmonies, I don't know if that's an exact translation, but I like that translation. I forget it, I copied it from somebody. Sometimes it's the 37 wings, you know, or the 37, what else?
Branches?
What?
Factors?
37 factors, yeah. Words like that that aren't so invigorating. But to me, you know, 37 harmonies, you know, you think harmony in music, harmony in views. This is nice, you know. Okay, so it's harmonies and that these are 37 factors that that we have to really generate and practice because they are harmonious with awakening. And if we want awakening, then these are things that we should learn. So like I said, the Tibetans don't go into these exactly as they're taught here, but the qualities that are discussed, yeah, those come up when you meditate in, you know, on the paramitas. Okay, so you get to awakening, you know, there's different ways to put it, yeah. Okay, so having discussed the higher training of concentration and the cultivation of serenity, we will now turn to the higher training in wisdom and the cultivation of insight. This involves the 37 harmonies with awakening, practices shared in the Pali and Sanskrit traditions. The 37 harmonies contain elements of all three higher trainings, and they all directly or indirectly cultivate the wisdom that realizes the four truths and the ultimate nature of reality. So this is the wisdom that eliminates ignorance and leads to nirvana. So that's where those 37 are directed at. From the perspective of the Sanskrit tradition, the fundamental vehicle teachings, as explained in the Pali, Chinese, and Tibetan canons, are the foundation of the entire path. Okay, so when His Holiness talks about different vehicles, yeah, he talks about the Shravaka or hearer vehicle, Pratyeka vehicle, Pratyeka Buddha vehicle, and then the universal vehicle, the Mahayana. The first two, yeah, the hearer vehicle or Shravaka and the Pratyeka Buddha or solitary realizer vehicle, those are both called fundamental vehicles. Yeah, because from the perspective of a person who practices Tibetan Buddhism, those are the fundamentals of Buddha Dharma that we have to learn. Yeah, so people who think, I'm going to do Tibetan Buddhism, I'm brand new, where's the first initiation to go to? No. Okay, we have to start with the fundamentals, which is everything we've been doing so far. Okay, are fundamentals easy? No. So just because something is called fundamental does not mean it's easy, does not mean it's quick. Okay, it just means that it is, it's the basis upon which to build a practice that's going to be successful. You know, like when we did this building, okay, we had to excavate, yeah, so do some purification, and then build the foundation. Yeah, without the foundation, you can't do the walls, you can't do the roof. Okay, yeah. So usually, so when His Holiness talks about three, you know, Shravaka, Pratyeka Buddha, Mahayana, yeah, the first two can be put together as a fundamental vehicle, yeah, and then the Mahayana, and to just repeat it one more time, is the Vajrayana is a branch of the Mahayana. It is not a separate tradition, okay? I'm sure you people know that, but I think many people listening. Yeah, because in the West they say, oh, three traditions, yeah, Vipassana, Zen, and Vajrayana. No. Okay, first of all, Vipassana is a meditation technique that's found in all Buddhist traditions. Okay, and Zen, like Vajrayana, are branches of the general Mahayana. Okay, so we have to, this way of speaking, you know, in the West, even in Singapore when we go, you know, and it's totally wrong, you know. But anyway, okay. So what's explained in the Pali, Chinese, and Tibetan canons are the foundation of the entire path. Okay. Now, in terms of the canons, it's quite interesting. I mean, the Pali canon has things in Pali. Okay. Chinese canon, it's been translated into Chinese. But many of the Pali suttas, yeah, fundamental vehicles, are also found in the Chinese canon. Yeah, they're called agamas, and they're very similar to the Pali texts, but they have some differences. And so I know Bhikkhu Bodhi and I think, Bhikkhu Anālaya are both studying that. Yeah, it's an open field for new research. Yeah. And then you have the tantras, which are part of the Tibetan canon. And some of them are in the Chinese canon as well. What's interesting is some of the things that the Tibetans consider Vajrayana, for the Chinese, they consider it Sutrayana, sutra practice, like the Amitabha Buddha practice, or the practice of any of the bodhisattvas. Yeah, in Chinese Buddhism, it's considered, you read the Amitabha Sutra, yeah, and you practice that as a sutra practice. The Tibetans usually consider those tantra, but it doesn't really matter what you consider them. Yeah, the texts are quite similar. Okay, so in the fundamental vehicle, yeah, and those teachings are found in all three canons. Here is where the four truths, three higher trainings, and 37 harmonies with awakening are first taught. On this basis, the Mahayana explains the third truth. Okay, so fundamental vehicle, first truth, first and second truth, dukkha and the causes of dukkha. Then Mahayana explains the third truth, true cessation. Of course, this is found in fundamental vehicle. But when His Holiness is saying this, he means that the Mahayana has taken true cessation as a topic and really developed it and explained a lot more about it than in the fundamental vehicle. And that goes for the sutras that would be under the true path as well, because it includes the whole Mahayana path, which you won't find in the Pali scriptures exactly like that. Yeah. Although the Pali tradition does have a bodhisattva path, and they have paramitas, which we will get to in a future volume, that many people don't know about this. Okay, so the Mahayana also, it goes into the third truth, true cessation and emptiness, in more detail in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. The Mahayana also delves deeper into the meaning of the cognizing subject and the true path in the Tathagatagarbha Sutra teachings. Okay? So the cognizing subject, the mind, yeah, and that's really gone into much more in the Mahayana. When you study Chittamatra, okay, Yogacharya teachings, more discussion about the mind, because the mind and the object arise from the same latency, okay? And then all the teachings about Buddha nature, those come in the Mahayana too. So on this basis, the Tantrayana teachings follow. Here we see that the fundamental vehicle emphasized in the Pali tradition and the Theravada, the Mahayana teachings of the perfection vehicle, and the Tantrayana teachings are not separate and unrelated paths, but the latter build upon the former. So this is very important. And this is where we see so many people getting confused. Yeah, because they don't get the foundation. And many people don't want to hear the foundation. Yeah. Ah, true dukkha. Birth. Well, birth is okay. Aging, sickness, death. You got to meditate on those with concentration. Can't get what you want. Get what you don't want. And then anger is bad and attachment is bad and all my emotions are bad. I don't want to hear this stuff, Okay. These are people, you know, I want the light and love and bliss. You know, I want something, you know, jazzy. And, yeah, the first two truths don't kind of jazz you up. Unless you're interested in liberation, then the first two truths, you know. I remember when I my first course, when they started talking about death and suffering, I went, finally, somebody was willing to talk about this. Because the way I grew up, I mean, you don't talk about death, because if you talk about it, it might happen. Yeah. Suffering, you don't want to talk about because it's too scary. Yeah. You don't want to hear about that. So nobody talks about it. How do you deal with these things? You know, and that's why so many people put off making their will, put off doing their medical directive, all these kinds of things, because they don't want to think about it. Yeah. And, you know, Buddhism wants us to think about these things, you know. And, like I said, my experience just hearing it is, oh, thank goodness, finally, people I can talk to about this. But it's not morose. Yeah, it's not morose. What it does is it makes your mind very calm. At least this is the effect it has on my mind. If I really go through, you know, the eight sufferings, the three kinds of dukkha, the six kinds of dukkha, and the human, you know, my mind gets really quiet. It's like, whatever it is that I'm complaining about today is inconsequential. It's a stupidaggio. There's more important things to think about, which is the situation I'm in samsara. Yeah. So, again, this happened when Geshe Nawandarge was teaching Aryadevas, the 400, and the early chapters of Aryadeva. You know, there's a whole chapter on death. Yeah. And Geshe-la was teaching that, you know, it was a small group of us, and like every day, you know, death and impermanence, death and impermanence. My mind was so peaceful. Yeah. My neighbor, we were living at the library, you know, she used to play her radio, and it's like, it drove me crazy. And it's like, it stopped driving me crazy. When you meditate on death, it's like, why am I getting upset about a radio? You know, and you look on a day-to-day basis, the things that, oh, you know, somebody, they didn't put this away, you know, this wasn't cleaned properly, da-da-da-da. These little things that we get really meh about are generally, they're not worth the effort. And so thinking about the first two truths are very good for quieting the mind down. Yeah. So when your mind starts going all over the universe, yeah, bring it back to what's going on now. Yeah. Impermanence, going towards death. Okay, let's deal with what's important. Yeah. My robe is just going to keep sliding off my shoulder, you know. That's all there is to it. I'm not going to get, you know, irritated. Yeah. Okay. So unfortunately, some practitioners of Tibetan Buddhism do not pay adequate attention to these valuable practices of the 37 harmonies with awakening. Unfortunately, he says, yeah, some practitioners don't pay attention to these things. While the 37 harmonies are explained in Mahayana sutras and commentaries, they are not widely practiced among followers of the Tibetan tradition. Perhaps this is because the Indo-Tibetan tradition, in the Indo-Tibetan tradition, these 37 practices are correlated with the levels of the five paths, as explained further on. So practitioners think that they are to be done later, after having attained a path. Yeah, maybe that's why they don't do it, or maybe, you know, people looking for glitter. Although the Tibetans start out, you know, with the fundamental vehicle. I mean, when you enter the monastery, there is a program and with different texts, and you do that program. And they usually don't like the monks who are doing the Geshe studies to take too many empowerments or any empowerments at all, because then when they have commitments, they don't have time to study and time to debate, which, you know, at that level of the path are the crucial things you need to do to get a good understanding. Okay. However, I read a sutra that explains how to include them in our daily practice, even at the beginner's level. And that's what we'll get, you know, because you can apply all of this. I would like to encourage Tibetan Buddhists to do these 37 practices, especially the four establishments of mindfulness. We meditate on them with a bodhicitta motivation and the prasangika view of emptiness. Yeah, and we do them with refuge, so they become a Mahayana practice, but they're quite potent practices, yeah? So studying the 37 harmonies gives me the wonderful opportunity to relate to the Buddha as disciples. I get a real sense of his life as a human being who lived on our earth and taught people like me. I feel very close to the Buddha, our marvelous teacher. Yeah, because when you read the sutras, you can imagine yourself being in that audience and him, you know, speaking to you. Most of the sutras were given in response to questions his disciples asked him, or they are follow-ups to questions he asked them or other renunciates. Because in some of the sutras, you know, after the Buddha, you know, went on alms roam and ate breakfast, you know, he would walk around, and he would often bump into the Jains or other matted hair ascetics, and he would stop and talk to them. And, you know, okay, guys, what are you doing now? What are you talking about? Yeah, what conclusions have you come to? So he, you know, he didn't just stay in his own silo. He was talking to everybody. And that's how many of the sutras were spoken, you know, just in terms they began because of a discussion like that. Okay. Someone would ask the Buddha, how do we develop this realization or that quality? Other times a problem would arise concerning a disciple's behavior, and one of the monks would ask the Buddha how to deal with it. And that's how we got all the stories in the Vinaya. Okay. And sometimes the Buddha, you know, in the sutras kind of reprimanded somebody, or somebody had a wrong view. Yeah, he would have some disciple who came in talking about God, and the Buddha would just, you know, did you ever hear me talk about that? Okay. So this is a very human way of interacting with the people around him, that the Buddha gave instructions on the 37 harmonies with awakening. Before speaking in depth about the 37 harmonies, there are two mental factors, mindfulness and introspective awareness, that are worthy of more attention because they play an important part in all three higher trainings. And when we talk about the 37 harmonies, mindfulness is eight of them. It comes up repeatedly in them. Okay. And so here, this is, yeah, how mindfulness works, how introspective awareness works, and how we use these not only in our meditation, but in our daily life. Yeah. Okay, so the importance of mindfulness and introspective awareness. Discussed in both Pali and Sanskrit traditions, the mental factors of mindfulness, which is sati in Sanskrit and Pali, sati, or smriti, it's smriti in Sanskrit, sati and it's samprajana for introspective awareness. And you'll hear our Theravada nuns often call it that. Okay, so discussed in both the Pali and Sanskrit traditions, the mental factors of mindfulness and introspective awareness primarily function to focus on what is important in the moment, be it our meditation object, the movement of our body, the reason for engaging in a certain activity, and so forth. Okay. They work together to keep our mind in virtue and to redirect our attention back to what is important, since it's strayed towards non-virtue. Yeah. So this is really a call for us to watch our mind closely. And what are we thinking? And what are we noticing? Because we are very glued to external objects. Yeah. Now, yes, we sleep, you know, some hours every day. But the rest of the day, our five senses are working. And so we look at things, we hear things, we smell, taste, and touch things. If we lack mindfulness and introspective awareness, our mind goes all over the place. And when you really start watching your mind, you know, what you're thinking about, okay? So when you're walking up the path to come to this building, yeah, what are you looking at? What's going on in your mind? Okay, are you noticing, you know, what are we looking at? And then, okay, so today we look down, snow. Yeah, snow. Then does your mind just say snow and then keep walking? No. Okay, what comes up in your mind after I'm seeing snow?
Shoveling.
I'm so happy. Huh? I'm so happy that there's snow. We want more of it. Shoveling. I don't want a shovel. Why hasn't somebody shoveled this yet? I have to go back and
get my cleats.
And get my cleats. Yeah. And then do you just stop with that? Or you start, I have to go back and get my cleats. And okay, do I have time to get them now? Or do I have to rush to class and I get them later? If I don't get them now, I might slip and fall, and that's not so good. Mind is off and running. Okay. Or snow, I feel so happy there's snow. I remember when I was a little kid, and, you know, in Pennsylvania, was it? And we used to go out and make snowmen. And I remember in the Abbey's early days when Sundru and Jampel would build snowmen and put a carrot for the nose and, you know, and yeah. And then again, mind off and running. Yeah. Why hasn't somebody shoveled it? Yeah. Nobody says, why haven't I shoveled it? Yeah. It's why hasn't somebody shoveled it? Well, I don't know. Again, we're so disorganized. I'm sure there's a rota. I'm sure it's in somebody's department. And people just don't, you know, look at what they're supposed to do. Yeah. And like, this is going on with everything. Da, da, da. And again, you're off and running. Yeah. Or I looked at the list, and it was Maitri who was supposed to shovel the snow, and she just didn't show up. Oh, leave it to Maitri. You know, she's sleeping. Yeah. Or she wants you to pet her some more. And Maitri's a cat, by the way. So, you know, just like we see one thing and then we start conceptualizing about it. How important are our mental chatter in this? When you're thinking about, I'm so happy, or who's going to shovel the snow, or, you know, it's cold, or I got to get my cleats. How important is this? Yeah. And is it a virtuous thought or a non-virtuous thought or a neutral thought? Why hasn't somebody done this? Sounds like irritation, non-virtue. Yeah. Oh, I remember playing in the snow as a kid. Yeah, attachment. And so this is going on all day, and we don't even notice. Yeah. Or we may notice what we're thinking, but we don't stop and assess, is this important? Is it worthwhile that I direct my human intelligence toward this topic? Yeah. And we see, boy, we put our human intelligence on the weirdest things. Yeah. Have you ever started noticing people's shoes? And which shoes belong to which people? And why do they have flashy shoes? Yeah, I know it's hard to get really modest shoes these days, so they got kind of the right color. I guess it's okay. But, you know, I mean, maybe we should have a standard shoe just like the Chinese do, and, you know, and not have people get their personal shoes. And, you know, somebody has blue shoes, somebody has tan shoes. You know, somebody else has purple shoes. Yeah. How many people have maroon shoes? You know, maybe you have bright red. That's as close to maroon as you get. Oh, you know, we can't even match our shoes. And, you know, we're off and running. And so-and-so, you know, they don't, they, when they say, you know, our abbess, you know, bless her heart, she wears her boots, you know, she doesn't take them off outside, she takes them off at the doorstep and then knocks the snow off right on the carpet outside the door where I want to wipe my feet. Oh, God, you know, why does she do that? But I can't say anything to her. She's the abbess, and it sounds rude. I should give her some space. But I sure wish she'd, you know, not do that. And she keeps doing it, yeah. And she has a reason, yeah. Because her feet get very, very cold, yeah? And she wants to put her feet and Venerable Sangha Khadro's feet, the heat in Sangha Khadro's feet, the freezing cold in her feet, put them together and average them so that we both have comfortable feet. But that doesn't happen, so that's why she does it. Yeah, so it's a good reason, yes? Open your heart to compassion. That's a virtuous thought. Okay? But are you getting my thing about what our mind is doing? Yes. Yeah. And to watch this, it's amazing. You know, what the mind goes to, that most of it is just we're wasting our time. Okay. So mindfulness and introspective alertness direct our mind to what is important should it stray towards non-virtue. They protect our minds from non-virtue, thus preventing suffering and obstacles on the path. prevent obstacles on the path? We want that. Okay, then we practice these. So Shantideva pleads, to those who wish to guard their minds, I make their appeal with palms joined. Shantideva's talking to us. You must use every effort to employ both mindfulness and introspective awareness. Yeah. So mindfulness and introspective awareness also enable us to work for the benefit of others, as Togme Zampo encourages in the 37 practices of a bodhisattva. In brief, whatever you are doing, ask yourself, what's the state of my mind? With constant mindfulness and introspective awareness, accomplish others' good. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. So mindfulness and introspective awareness not only protect the mind from non-virtue, but they enable us to accomplish the good of others, what's good for others. So mindfulness and introspective awareness will be explained separately, and then we'll see how they operate together. So first, mindfulness. The original meaning of mindfulness in Indian languages is memory or recollection, okay? It means to remember, to recollect. The Buddha used this ordinary word, but gave it a new meaning specific to his doctrine. Yeah, and we see this a lot. He'll take an ordinary word that is used, but he'll give it a new meaning. Mm-hmm. Like the word Bhagavan or Tathagata. Yeah, they were prominent. They were used in India, but he gave them new meanings. So according to the two knowledges, the two Abhidharma texts, one written by who? Vasubandhu, the other written by Asanga, who were brothers. So according to the two knowledges, mindfulness is a distinct mental factor that repeatedly brings to mind a phenomena of previous acquaintance without forgetting it. So a mental factor is an aspect of the general mind, of the general state of the mind, of the general cognition or thought, you know. It's a mental factor that is affiliated with that general mind, but it performs a specific function. Okay? So the primary mind would be the visual consciousness, auditory consciousness, your five sense consciousness, and the mental consciousness. And they are primary minds because they cognize specific objects. Visual consciousness perceives sights, auditory hears sounds, and so on. Okay? But they can't do it alone. They have these other aspects that enable them to perceive, to experience that, you know, the emotions, how you react to it, the feelings, the emotions, the views, all sorts of different aspects of consciousness. Those are mental factors. Okay, so they are not present. There's some five mental factors that are in all consciousnesses, but, you know, not all mental factors are. Like, thank goodness, anger isn't in every mental consciousness. We're not angry all the time, okay? So it, you know, it's calling it a mental factor. And these are mental factors that we can consciously develop. Some of the mental factors are afflictions. We can consciously subdue those and cut them off. Other ones are virtuous. Other ones, like mindfulness and introspective awareness, are tools to develop, you know, to help us create virtue. And if we don't use them to create virtue, we're using them to create non-virtue, which is not so good. Okay, so the Buddha used this ordinary word, but gave it a new meaning specific to his doctrine. Okay, so according to the two knowledges, mindfulness is a distinct mental factor that repeatedly brings to mind a phenomena of previous acquaintance without forgetting it. In the Compendium of Knowing, a Sangha says, what is mindfulness? So here he's going to give us a definition. In regard to a familiar object, the mind is not forgetful and operates without distraction. So that means mindfulness has three features. The first one, it's focal object. Yeah, so that's the object it's focusing on. So that's got to be a familiar object. It can't be generated towards an unfamiliar object, because how can you be mindful and aware of something that you don't know, you know? At least you know some. You may not know the specific word for it, but you can perceive it, yeah. Okay, so focal object is for familiar object. The subject, this is the second quality, the subject, the mind, is not forgetful of the object, meaning that it is focused on that object and not distracted from it. So here you can see how it's really important when we're developing concentration. Mindfulness is what we use at the beginning of the meditation to really put the mind on that object. Yeah, and keep it there. And then the third quality of mindfulness is its function, which is to prevent distraction to other objects. So that's what it does. When your mindfulness is strong on a familiar object, yeah, it prevents getting distracted to other objects. Yeah. So in your meditation, when you know, when you find that you're in La La Land and you've been meditating on, you know, a grudge you've been holding for the last 10 years, or you're dreaming about the future or what you're gonna do, okay, you're distracted from your main object there. Okay. But that means your mindfulness isn't strong. Okay. After attention has been placed on the meditation object, mindfulness keeps it there. So attention is one of the five that come with all consciousnesses. So it directs your mind to that object, and then mindfulness, boom, keeps it there. When discussing mindfulness as one of the five faculties are one group that's found in the 37 harmonies. Okay, the Buddha described mindfulness here. And what monastics is the faculty of mindfulness? Here, monastics, the Arya disciple is mindful, possessing supreme mindfulness and discretion. One who remembers and recollects what was done and said long ago. He dwells contemplating the body in the body, feelings in feelings, mind in mind, phenomena in phenomena, ardent, introspectively aware, mindful, having removed longing and displeasure for the world. This is called the faculty of mindfulness. Okay, so there's a lot here. So he presents it as a question. What's the faculty of mindfulness? So here he's talking about an Arya disciple, somebody who, with the union of serenity and insight, has realized emptiness directly. So he's giving us the top level of what you want to aim for. Okay, which, if I can digress for a minute, during one of the conferences of Western Buddhist teachers with His Holiness, I think it was the one in 93, you know, people had the opportunity to ask His Holiness questions. And so Alex Verson, yeah, asked His Holiness, he said, you know, when we read the sutras, we hear about how the perfect version of things, okay? So here, mindfulness, it stays on the object and it prevents distraction, yeah? And that's what you want to cultivate, you know? And Alex said, but, you know, we're not at that level. And it presents everything that is so high, you know, that, and we're not there yet. And it can be a little bit discouraging. His Holiness said, I mean, his, Alex said to His Holiness. His Holiness thought the question was quite amusing. Yeah. But he also took it quite very seriously, you know, and he said, the sutras and the teachings always present us with where we want to get to, the best version of what we're talking about. Because if you don't know what the best version is, how are you going to develop it when you're low on the ladder? You know, you won't know what to do and how to direct your mind if you don't know where you're going. Okay. And so he said, don't worry about it being more advanced than where you're at. You are where you are. Yeah. But now you can look and see, oh, I'm aiming for that. Now what steps do I need to take? How do I develop it? Okay. So that was my digression. Yeah. Okay. So he's talking about an Arya. We're not Aryas, but this is where we want to go. So an Arya is mindful. Yeah. He's focused on the object, possessing supreme mindfulness and discretion. So especially to be an Arya, you have to have very good mindfulness. Your mind can't wiggle around to other objects. And discretion. I think Aryas, when they come out of their meditative equipoise, they use discretion and wisdom to figure out what they're going to do. Yeah, I mean, they come out of it. So, yeah, am I going to teach? Am I going to make lunch? How do I do this? Yeah, how do I benefit sentient beings? How do I protect my, and so on. Okay, they use discretion. So it's one who remembers and recollects what was done and said long ago. So I remember how my second grade teacher wouldn't let me be in the class play. Yeah, I remember being 4 years old and my dad and having that meltdown over the roller skates. Yeah, what things do we remember? Sometimes we remember really bad things that happened to us. Yeah, we focus on them. Yeah, I remember, you know, when my parents got blew up and, you know, told me they were going to kill me. My mom used to say, you know, I could have killed you, you know, but I knew she didn't mean it. But, yeah, so, yeah, and then they went from, you know, they decided a better thing was to knock our heads together. So that's what they threatened to do, knock our heads together. And one time they did it. Yeah. I'm hard-headed, as you know. Okay. So one who remembers and recollects what was done and said long ago. This is referring to the teachings that you've had. You know, not to the grudges you've had, the people who have insulted you, how they've been rude to you, all the things that you haven't done well yet. You know, it's not talking about remembering that. And it's not talking about, you know, going on your first date, your first prom, and, you know, and playing the guitar and, you know, showing off your mohawk and things like that. It's not talking about remembering that stuff. But we remember that stuff. We just don't remember the teachings, do we? Yeah. So he dwells contemplating the body in the body, feelings and feelings. So I'm going to read now a little bit more. His Holiness explains that. So contemplating the body in the body means contemplating the body as a body. It's not, you know, oh, there's a body in my body. No, that's not what it means. You're contemplating the body as a body. What is a body? What are the characteristics of the body? So this indicates the specific object of contemplation. It is the mere body, not the painful, pleasurable, and neutral feelings it generates in us. That would be when you're meditating on mindfulness of the feelings, but just contemplating the body as a mere body, not the feelings we get from it, just what it is. Not our ideas about our body, not our like or dislike of the body. Oh, I like a body that's shaped like that. I like a body that has teeth like that. I really want my eyes to be like diamonds and my teeth like, you know, whatever it is. Okay? Yeah. Or I don't like my body. And here you have people doing, young people now, doing plastic surgery on their body. Sometimes their body isn't really even fully developed, and they're already trying to change it. And this is especially happening in young girls, in teenage girls and young women, because you look at the images in the magazine, and of course nobody looks like that, but everybody wants to look like that. Yeah, so it used to, you know, now you need, what's it called, a Brazilian butt, but something, it's a butt tuck. You haven't heard of a butt tuck? When your butt is too big, yeah, and you want your tush to be a different shape. It's too big or it's sagging. You know, when you wear those really tight clothes, you don't want a sagging rear end. Okay. Yeah. Some of you look horrified. But really, you know, this is what they're doing. And for women, breasts, you know, it used to be they want breast implants to make them bigger. Now you want them smaller. And so there's breast reduction. Yeah. For the guys, it's, you know, build up your muscles, build up your six-pack. Doesn't he call it six-pack? Yeah, I don't know why it's called a six-pack. But anyway, you know, build that up, you know, go to the gym. So it's mindfulness of the body is not talking about that. Okay, so we shouldn't do mindfulness of the body and come out of the meditation of I'm going to get a sign up to go to the gym, you know, or I think I want to go see a plastic surgeon. You know, I don't like the shape of my nose. I mean, all these years I've had a big Jewish nose and I didn't even realize it. You know, I want to have a nose job now at my age. Yeah, right. That's going to go over big. No, it'll go over small, you know, a small nose. But His Holiness says all Westerners have big noses. Yeah. Yeah. For Tibetans, yeah, we have big noses. Okay. So it indicates the specific object to contemplation. It is the mere body, not the painful, pleasurable, and neutral feelings it generates in us, not our ideas about our body, our like or dislike of the body, but simply what is there. A momentary body that is in the nature of dukkha and that neither has a self nor is a self. When you examine exactly what the body is, okay? It's something momentary, impermanent, changing every moment. It's not permanent. We are aging, folks. Yeah, it's in the process of disintegrating. Yeah. It's in the nature of dukkha. It's unsatisfactory by nature. Yeah. It's going to decay and generate and die. Yeah. And while it's alive, it sometimes is very uncooperative. It gets cancer, it gets kidney disease, your stomach goes up into your esophagus, you know, your lungs are compressed, your knees hurt, your legs hurt, you need this part replaced and that part replaced. Okay, it's in the nature of dukkha. But here, you don't get into, oh, I don't like, you know, I need a hip replacement. I don't want to have a hip replacement. It hurts too much. That's not what you're meditating on. You're just looking at what the body is and how it works, how it operates. It's something that's impermanent, and it's something that is unsatisfactory in nature. It breaks down. Yeah. And, you know, you can't take it. You can't. You don't get a certificate when you get the body that if it breaks within the next 6 months, you can return it, you know. And there's no guarantee. You don't get your body with a guarantee. So that's unsatisfactory, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, and it neither has a self nor is a self. Really? But I think my mind is myself. Yeah. And when I don't think that my mind is myself, I feel like there's a self floating around. Yeah. Some people, their self is up here. My self is here. Yeah. Where's your self? Mm-hmm. Here. Yeah. Where you really feel things here, isn't it? Yeah. But that's not a self. If you cut it open, you don't find something. And what is it? Your pituitary gland. You don't find a little homunculus there. Cutting it open, it goes, "Hi, I'm the self." No. Yeah. Okay. The same. Then feelings and feelings, mind and mind, phenomena and phenomena. So the same thing. Impermanent, the nature of dukkha, and neither is a self nor has a self, pertains to feelings, mind, and phenomena. In short, mindfulness focuses on its object in a way that both remembers it and observes its characteristics just as they are. So it remembers it and observes the characteristics. So here you see mindfulness is, it's going to be friends with wisdom. Okay? Remembers it. It observes the characteristics. Wisdom comes in and helps with the analytical process of just, you know, figuring out what actually is the body. Impermanent, nature of dukkha, selfless. Conjoined with introspective awareness and wisdom, mindfulness brings insight into the nature of the object. So, you know, for example, when we start with the body, yeah, some of us remember the body is beautiful movement, yeah, because many people grew up with, you know, your body is evil, it has desire, you know, you should, you know, kind of very negative towards the body. So there was a movement, kind of late 60s, early 70s. Yeah, the body is beautiful. And so people wrote books about the body is beautiful, and you should see your body as beautiful. Yeah. And mindfulness you know, what the body is exactly, it doesn't, from a Buddhist perspective, you don't see it as beautiful. What people found in this secular way of the body is beautiful, and this is the way, like, Christians would look at the body. God created it, and it's amazing how it works. You know, you eat food, it goes down here, you don't have to do anything. Your stomach digests it, it goes into your intestine, which takes out the nutriments, and it sloughs off all the stuff you don't want. And isn't that wonderful? The body, who could have designed something that works so incredibly like this, you know? And it's beautiful, you know, even when your skin ages, it's beautiful because it, you know, shows the nature of your body and, you know, the God-given. And anyway, it's sexy. And that's the bottom line. Okay? So that was the body of beautiful movement, wasn't it? Yeah. And Buddhism is not designed to get you to that conclusion. Yeah? Yeah. That conclusion is good for business. It will sell beauty products to both men and women. It manifests in all these gyms. There used to not be so many gyms. Now there's gyms all over the place. You know, all these different body training programs. Yeah. So it's good for business, but it's not mindfulness that the way that Buddha wanted us to practice. Okay. So conjoined with introspective awareness and wisdom, it brings insight into the nature of the object. Yeah. So especially with feelings, yeah, when you really observe the feelings, yeah. Very, you know, happy feeling. What does a happy feeling feel like? And can you hold, how long can you hold on to a happy feeling? Yeah. Or a pleasant feeling. Yeah, a pleasant feeling. When you eat, you know, that first bite of chocolate. Yeah, how long does that feeling of pleasure last? Not very long. And sometimes afterwards, depending on if they put orange juice and vinegar in the chocolate. You know, you may even have an unpleasant taste in your mouth afterwards. Yeah. Now it isn't orange juice. Now the big thing in our kitchen is lemon. Okay, put lemon in everything. Okay. Yeah, you can't have a little lemon juice. You know, they sell bottles of lemon juice at the store. And you can have one there for the people who like it. But no, we put it in, okay? I'm not complaining. I'm just pointing something out.
Observing it as it is.
What?
Observing it as it is.
Yes. Yes. I'm observing an additive.
And not running away with any kind of concepts.
Adjective.
As it is.
As it is. Why don't you speak English?
I try. Observing it as it is.
Is, yeah. Okay. So what does that have to do with lemon? Okay. Conjoined with introspective awareness and wisdom, it brings insight into the nature of the object. So mindfulness also means memory, calling to mind, I call that to mind, and recollection. It recollects the precepts so that we can live within their boundaries. That's good, isn't it? We need to remember our precepts. If we don't remember our precepts, then pretty soon we won't have them anymore. Yeah? So it's, we need that kind of mindfulness. Yeah, it prevents, mindfulness prevents the mind from becoming engrossed in sense objects, daydreams, and anxious thoughts. Well, the first two, sense objects and daydreams, what's wrong with that? Why can't my mind be engaged in that? Sense objects. Look how beautiful the design on this gong. Look, it has two eyes, the Buddha's two eyes and the nose on the bottom. Why is that on the bottom? Yeah. And the color here. Yeah. So we get, become engrossed in sense objects. Okay. Daydreams. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Yeah. Daydreams. Yeah. What did you daydream about this retreat? Sometimes there's very... there's common daydreams that come up very often. See, you can't even remember your daydreams. I bet you weren't even aware when you were having them. Do you remember any of your... you're too embarrassed to say.
I'll tell you one.
What?
I'll tell you one.
Okay.
She's always good for exposing.
What? What'd you say?
She's always good for exposing her
mind. Yeah.
I spent quite a few sessions daydreaming about what I would do if I was president of the United States. How could I, you know, get over, you know, just get in there, how I would make the whole process up there and what I would do with the situations that are in the world right now.
Yeah.
It was pretty romanticized. I got everything right. Everybody liked me. I settled the whole process of the wars in the world and,
yeah, and America. And you fired certain people.
And I did fire some certain people. We brought them to justice. But the American people loved me and, you know, everything was fine.
Oh, that you just copied Donnie's playbook. That's what he thinks, too.
But it was very interesting because, like, what kind of virtue would I have as a president? Yeah. That was really what I was trying to get to, was what do you need to really do this job right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. What kind of virtue do you need to be a good leader? Yeah. And to be a good follower and to be a good whatever we are. And it also, daydreaming about that also shows us how difficult it is to... for change to occur, yeah? That you think you have power, you're going to put the edict on it, that's the way it's going to be? Mm-mm. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the war with Iran was supposed to be over already, after the first hour. Yeah, because... he laid down the law, and we're not putting up with this. Well, you know, change depends on many, many conditions and causes. Okay. So mindfulness prevents the mind from being engrossed in sense objects, daydreamings, and some of you have this favorite one, anxious thoughts. Oh, that's why you didn't raise your hand when I asked about daydreams. What are your anxious thoughts? Oh, you're all smiling. Everybody with anxious thoughts is smiling right now.
Giving a BBC.
You're anxious about that. What else? Yeah?
Not being good enough for the Abbey.
Not being good enough. Okay. Good enough in what? There's so many ways to be good enough and not good enough. Yeah. You've got to pick some ways in which you're not good enough. Yeah. Okay, I admit it. I cannot bowl. You know? When I bowl, it goes in the gutter, and that's it. Okay. Yeah. I can't play golf. Yeah, first of all, But I'm not particularly anxious over those things. Yeah.
She said living at the Abbey. She specified.
What?
Not being good enough for the Abbey.
Not being good enough for the Abbey. Mm-hmm. Oh, so there's a standard to be good enough for the Abbey?
You have to
meditate
on deities. You have to be able to generate the four, what are they called again? Immeasurables. Well, you have to keep up with all the studies and make hundreds of prostrations and cook delicious meals and give BBCs, yes, and set motivations in the morning that are all brilliant like everybody else's.
Yeah. And all your mind is so preoccupied with anxious thoughts that you can't do any of those things,
exactly,
like give a BBC, because you don't have time to think about it because you're too anxious about giving it. There's a few other people that have that problem too. Kind of see, you're just sitting near each other. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're forming a clique. The anti-BBC talk clique. Okay. Mindfulness counteracts absent mindfulness. Oh my goodness, does that mean I'm going to remember Chinese names? God. And I'm always writing her and saying, please remind me where I know this person from. Yeah. And it isn't just Chinese names, it's, you know, Western rhymes, it's easier, but I forget those too. It counteracts mindfulness and protects us from non-conscientiousness. Non-conscientiousness is when you value ethical conduct. Yeah, you're conscientious. You value, you think virtue is important. Non-conscientiousness is caring about our virtue is out the window because we're involved in a daydream. Yeah, something like that. Yeah. So it protects us from non-conscientiousness. It protects us from being so focused on the plethora of inner preconceptions that we do not pay attention to what is at hand. Like you're so busy thinking of what the next steps are going to be and how you're in a hurry that you're not paying attention to what somebody is asking you right now. Yeah, or somebody is telling you right now. Mindfulness increases our store of knowledge by focusing our mind when we are listening to teachings and enabling us to remember them later. What was that Dharma talk about? What was she talking about? Yeah, I remember she talked about her second grade teacher. She talked about her big nose. What was the Dharma? What was the Dharma in that talk? Yeah. Okay. So mindfulness increases our store of knowledge by focusing our mind when we are listening to teachings and enabling us to remember them later. This twofold function of mindfulness, taking in what is happening in the present and recalling it afterwards, facilitates learning, contemplation, and meditation on the Buddhist teachings, as well as applying the teaching in all facets of our life. You know, so you've heard that it's very nice, you know, if you're meditating on a specific Lam Rim topic, then during the break time to think about it, and when you look around, you know, see everything in terms of that Lam Rim object. But do we even remember to do that when we're on a break time? Yeah, or this is asking us to look really carefully at what's going on in our mind and evaluating if it's virtue or non-virtue. You know, can we do that? This is the homework now. Okay. Okay. And then applying it in all facets of our life. Mindfulness reminds us of the goals of spiritual practice. We remember them. Attaining fortunate rebirth, liberation, and full awakening. In the practice of ethical conduct, it remembers our precepts, preventing non-virtuous actions. In the cultivation of concentration, it remembers the meditation object, preventing distraction and restlessness. In the context of developing wisdom, it enables the mind to stay on the object and, together with wisdom, examines the person and the aggregates. Okay, that's what the four establishments are of mindfulness are on, things to do with the person and the aggregates. And then you can extrapolate them to external objects as well. In daily life, mindfulness remembers what has been done and what needs to be done. Okay, oh, I have to say so many mantra of this. Did I do that today? You know, and you can't remember because you do it every day. And so when your days are similar, it's like, did I do that? Yes, that I did that practice. Did I do it yesterday? Did I do it today too? Oh, I can't remember. Yeah. So mindfulness remembers what has been done and what needs to be done. It distinguishes what is worthy of our attention and what is not. Oh, sitting and mulling over how much people don't like me, that's really not worthy of my attention. Yeah, I sit there and just think, you know, this person doesn't like me because I failed in this. That person doesn't like me because I blew that. Oh, you know, is that a worthy object to focus the mind on? Why isn't it worthy? What?
It's not. We just made it up. It's a fictional story.
It's fictional stories. What we're saying to ourselves about ourselves is a big pack of lies. Yeah, it's fiction. We're good fiction writers. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it distinguishes what is worthy of our attention and what is not. So you can see when you're starting to like, okay, I'm picking up that same anxious thought. You know, I'm starting to go over it, or I'm starting to go over again, you know, what happened with this, to go over what happened. I said this, and they said that, and they didn't understand what I said, and my logic was completely reasonable and accurate, and I've gone over it in my mind 5,000 times. You know, why doesn't the world believe what I say? So, you know, it distinguishes what is worthy of our attention and what is not. 5,000 times we have to think the same thing and go over the whole thing again in our mind. Yeah. Is that worthy of our attention as Buddhist practitioners? Yeah. Oh, I walked into Ananda. Yeah. And Upekkha was lying right there in the door, on the carpet in the doorway. And I almost tripped over him, even though he's the biggest cat. And why does Upekkha always sleep there? Maybe we should, put him somewhere, you know, make him a little fenced-in area so he isn't lying right, you know, when you enter the door to step on. But actually, I like when he's there. It's kind of nice seeing Upekkha. He's a nice guy. I can bend down and pet him. I like the kitties. The kitties make me relaxed. Yeah. Except when they bite. And Mudita sometimes will. And then, you know, you're off and running, going round and around with all my opinions, all my, you know, like and dislike, all the I want things to be exactly like this, and the world is not organized like I want it to be. I'm so frustrated. Yeah. Okay. So if we have mindfulness, we notice, oh, I'm off and running on, you know, into one of my self, put myself down, tell myself I'm inferior, unloved drama. I'm putting myself into that. Or I'm putting, you know, rerunning the whole thing with Buddha Boy at the beach before we got sunburned. You know, actually that wasn't so bad, you know, and then you're off. You know, but it was bad. You know, it hurt. And then after you get sunburned, you got to put this gooey stuff on, and then your skin peels. And okay, yeah. So mindfulness is able to look at that, and it's like, okay, not going to think. Stop, mind. We're not thinking about that anymore. Yeah. Okay. So it remembers what has been done, what needs to be done, distinguishes what is worthy of our attention and what is not. The Buddha compared mindfulness to a gatekeeper that safeguards what is important. So this also is from the Pali Sutras. Just as the royal frontier fortress has a gatekeeper, wise, experienced, intelligent, to keep out those he doesn't know, and to let in those he does. Oh, it sounds like Christy Noem. Oops. Okay, I take that back. Future generations who listen to this won't know who she is. But we all know who she is, don't we? You don't know who she is?
It's okay.
Yeah. We'll explain.
Yeah, we'll tell you after class. Okay, so the gatekeeper, he keeps out those he doesn't know. He lets in those he does. Why? For the protection of those within and to ward off those without. In the same way, an Arya disciple is mindful, highly meticulous, remembering and able to call to mind even things that were done and said long ago. With mindfulness as his gatekeeper, the Arya disciple abandons what is unskillful, develops what is skillful, abandons what is blameworthy, develops what is blameless, and looks after himself with purity. Okay, so these are the benefits of cultivating mindfulness. Yeah, you can abandon what's unskillful, pay attention, develop what is beneficial and virtuous, abandon what is blameworthy, all those anxious thoughts going round and around about how you're inferior, nobody loves you. Okay, develop what is blameless, a mind of compassion. Yeah. Mind of love, a mind of the four immeasurables. Yeah. And looks after himself with purity. That's what that disciple does. Yeah. Okay. Maybe we should stop here. We might have a few comments or questions before we go on. Yeah.
I hadn't really thought about the lately about the value of having done the establishments of mindfulness meditation, the two retreats we've already done on it. But listening to this, what I'm and what you're saying right here now, it's clear to me that there's like a preschool aspect to this, because we don't actually know that what we're thinking is not appropriate because we've always thought it and we were taught to think it and everybody else thinks it. So even just learning to recognize that, oh, this really isn't a Dharma mind, right? It takes a lot.
Yeah.
It takes a lot. So I know that that's mindfulness too, but like these Arya values are really inspiring, but just like, honey, that's not a Dharma. That's not a virtuous thought. Okay. Just even that is
a lot.
Yeah. 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 And I mean, you have a good point there, because the Buddhist way of thinking and the societal way of thinking don't match, you know. I mean, society has good ways of thinking too. Not everything is bad. But so often they don't match. And the popular views don't, you know, what the, because if the common views of common people match the Buddha's views, everybody would be practicing the Dharma and we would have tons of Aryas around. Yeah. But it, we're, you know, people who are trying to practice this are like white crows. Yeah, how often do you see a white crow? Yeah. So like you said, just to be able to notice what we're thinking and differentiate, is this worthwhile or not? Is this, you know, using my potential or is it wasting my time?
And what is worthwhile anyway?
Huh?
What?
Is it worthwhile? And then what is worthwhile? Yes. What does worthwhile mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
What is a worthwhile being? And what is somebody who takes care of themselves with purity? What does purity mean? You know, you take a bath 5 times a day? Yeah. You drink, you know, what is it? Yeah, who knows? Yeah. To be pure inside, kill all the bacteria inside. Yikes, you'll get really sick. So, yeah. I mean, to have a Dharma mind, it takes time and a lot of reflection, a lot of bumping up against the wall. And it's like, you know, my mind doesn't want to change. I think this is right. Yeah.
Whoa.
What?
That stretch of coming all the way back, I'm impressed with myself.
Oh, very good. We didn't even hear you creak. Okay, your question, comment?
I think my question is similar to Venerable Chinny's, but I'm so habituated to this way of going off. You know, the five senses are going all the time. So I think there has to be some preliminary steps here before you even get to the point of saying, okay, what's valuable here? And so I'm wondering what you did in your earlier years of practice.
Listen, I'm still doing it.
Do you set a motivation before you step out of prajna? I mean...
Well, every morning I set a motivation. First, you know, when I'm opening my eyes, I set a motivation. And this is also why at the beginning of everything we do here at the Abbey, we do some chanting or we set a motivation. It's just we forget the motivation after a while.
Yeah, we do. I do.
Yeah. Venerable Semke?
Oh, well, it's from last week, Venerable, this whole idea that if we look at this sense object and then we're off and running, but it's all about the attachment and the aversion piece, the three feelings. You know, if mindfulness says rein yourself in, well, what does that mean? Does that mean I shut down my entire feeling life, my whole existence? We go right to the other side of the planet and say, yeah. Now I'm going to be just this dull, boring, lifeless bump on a log.
But pure.
Yeah. But pure, yeah.
Pure bump on the log.
So there is a real, the resistance is from, you know, if I can't be like this, there's no other alternative.
Yeah.
You know, knowing that mindfulness brings an experience that we're not familiar with at the level that it's asking.
We train in it.
Yeah.
That's why the Buddha is teaching it, so that we can figure out what it is and then train the mind in it. Yeah. If we already knew what it was and were expert at practicing mindfulness, we wouldn't need this teaching. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Can you be mindful of a non-virtuous object?
Yeah.
So this mental factor is actually neutral.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not automatically virtuous. Your mindfulness of a negative object, you know, that's what's going on when you're planning how you're going to retaliate when you don't like somebody. You are very mindful of that person, of the action you want to do, the results you want. Yeah. Yeah, we don't want that kind of mindfulness. Anything else? Okay.
I'm just giving it back to the teacher.
Okay, then we will dedicate.